So I'm Shubhadeep. I am a Lagrange postdoctoral fellow at IAP Paris. So as the title says, I'm going to talk about a new probe, cosmological probe to measure axion-like particles from upcoming CMB service. So if you see our current cosmological status, for last few decades, we have a lot of observations, observational probes, and like CMB, large-scale structure, standard candles, and several underlying knowledge of our fundamental physics, we have developed a model for standard cosmology. We know pretty much what are the ingredients possibly are there, like dark matter, dark energy, baryons, this is from Planck, recent Planck measurements, and we have an idea about the reincarnation, about the history, cosmic history. We have an idea, but there are several things which you do not know. There are several things which are not, it do not understand yet. And there is a lot of work which is, a lot of science scope which are there for the upcoming missions to explore. And one of my main research interests is on the fact that how I can use the cosmological probes to understand about this fundamental physics, about what is dark matter, dark energy, or if you can ask how the theory of gravity. Because now we have measurements, we have a lot of upcoming surveys, and possible these things can be answered with future missions in both in CMB, in large-scale structure, in gravitational waves, and so on. So for the first part of my talk, I'll mainly talk about a new probe to axion-like particles from CMB, as is said in the title. But if time permits, I will also tell briefly about a few scopes from large-scale structure and from gravitational experiments to measure about fundamental physics. So to give a very brief introduction about CMB, CMB is discovered in 1965. We didn't see any fluctuations, the spatial fluctuation. We didn't see any deviation from blackbody. Followed by that, we have several experiments which has measured CMB very well, such as COBE, WMAP, Planck. We measured temperature fluctuations. We measured the polarization fluctuations as well. So this is the part which is the blackbody part of this CMB with spatial fluctuations. There's also non-blackbody part, which you can be expressed by the Y distortion, by mu distortion, by recombination lines. And some of them can have both spatial fluctuations or may not have any spatial fluctuation. But this is a quantity we have not yet measured. So sorry, I do not have a real map to show you here. There are some observational constraints, we have bounds, but we are yet to measure a full sky map of this. And my talk is mainly going to be about another new kinds of distortion, which is because of axion-like particles. So to explain in a very simple language what kind of spectral distortion I'm talking about, or when I say spectral distortion, I mean deviation from the blackbody spectrum. So if you consider a photon, if the presence of an external magnetic field interacts and gets converted into an axion-like particle. This is the main interaction which I'm talking about. So when this happens, if you start with a pure photon state, and you note by P is here, you convert a few of them into axion and some frequency level, and some of them not. So if I know initially what is my distribution of photons, I can ask how the thing got deviated from that initial distribution. And that's what we call as the spectral distortion of the signal. And this is something people in particle physics are really very interested about. They measure it. They look for axion-like signals from CERN, CERN's Axion Search Telescope, CAS. But the idea is that from CERN, we'll have a lot of solar axion flux, which they will pass through a high magnetic field, about a few Tesla, and want to see lights in the other side. And they put bound on this, effect. And this is the current bound by this paper. The point is, what happened, so I am going to talk about another kind of effect, which is just opposite to this, which is about conversion of photon to axion. And here we are talking about CME photons. So CME photons are black body photons. So we know the shape, and we are asking what distortion, because of magnetic field of several astrophysical systems, we can expect in this black body shape. The first thing I'll talk about is distortion because of one system like Milky Way. So this is, we worked out this in this particular paper, we can find more details there. So let me first explain you very simply what exactly we are talking about. So let's say I have our own galaxy, which has electron density very high at the center. It goes down as you go to the higher altitudes. It has magnetic field, and photons are getting from all directions, let's say isotropically. Now, in presence of the magnetic field, which is denoted by these red arrows here, if a photon, when it goes through this halo, the photon which is parallel to this magnetic field gets converted into an axion. And the one which is orthogonal to the direction of the magnetic field doesn't convert. So if I have a bunch of photons at a part which has a known black body shape entering the system, it interacts with the magnetic field, and when it comes out after the interaction, you see one photon. So here both you is a black body, completely, let's say, unpolarized photon. Here you generate a polarized photon. See, there's only one component of it. So the spectral distortion which you now produce is a polarized spectral distortion. Of this quantity depends upon the electron density. As a result, if you go to a place where I have higher density, the conversion is low. So because electron density or the magnetic field in the galaxy is not constant, it's specially varying, we expect this signal to specially vary. So it's a polarized spectral distortion in the black body, which is now specially fluctuating. And this is our main signal and way to measure axion-like particles from cosmological surveys. So if I increase the magnetic field, which I have shown here by this big red arrow, I convert both the photons, even if I'm in high electron density. So it really depends upon how my magnetic field strength varies in galaxy, how the electron density varies, and with that, how much of the photons gets converted into axion. To solve this problem, I'll explain in a very simple language initially, but to solve this problem, you have to solve this coupled differential equation. Where, so this part are like depends upon the effective mass of the photon in the plasma. This is like axion mass you're talking about. And these of terms are the coupling between photons and axion. So this is called the coupling strength, which is denoted by this G parameter, which is, and this coupling also includes the magnetic field part, which is denoted by this B. Now if you, this is a photon state, and you solve this equation. So if I know the magnetic field of a system I'm talking about, if I know the electron density, I can solve this equation along the line of sight. And this is what is the first idea we implement to find how the semi-photons, the pure photon state, gets how much of them gets converted into axion and which we can measure. So this particular distortion can be classified into two groups, resonance conversion and non-resonance conversion. The resonance conversion happens when the effective mass of the photon in the plasma equals the axion mass. So this doesn't happen throughout the line of sight. If all the places where I have this effective mass of photon equals axion mass, I have a resonance, else not. Other one is the non-resonance conversion, which happens throughout the line of sight of the propagation of the photon. So at first I'll talk about the non-resonant conversion. So to bring the same picture again, you have a photon coming. It interacts with the magnetic field, which follows a particular shape. And if you have an electron density, we have a particular distribution. We follow that through it, along the line of sight, and solve the differential equation, and ask how many of them gets converted. And when I say distortion, what I mean is, if you observe, this is the intensity you observe, is a black body intensity, which you expect, and that deviation is the probability of conversion from photon to axion. So we do that. We solve this equation for, let's using the electron density model of Cordes-Lazio and magnetic field model of Jensen and Farrar. So these are observation-driven models. We use them. So we have a 3D structure now along a choice of your line of sight. Let's here we have chosen like B equal to 70 and L is about 60, 120, 180, and 270, the galactic coordinates. You solve this equation, and what you see, you start from zero, then you have some probability of 10 to minus 11, you start increasing, then you keep on going down, and when it reaches Earth, it's nothing, it's 10 to minus 16. So this is the distance from Earth to the far, as far as we're talking about. So for resonant, non-resonant conversion, the signal is extremely weak. It's 10 raised to minus 16. To give you a typical value, this means 1 part in 10 raised to 16, there will be a fluctuation in CME temperature. And in this scale, why distortion? When you talk about SZ, you are going to measure very well. This is about 10 raised to minus 6. So this is not going to be happening in any time scale. At least I know about. But if I have turbulent magnetic field, so this is what we estimate using the turbulent magnetic field. We cannot use the model of Jensen and Farrar here. In that case, there will be a non-adiabatic, non-resonant conversion. What happens is the typical length scale over which the photons are converting into axion is much larger than the scale over which your electron density or magnetic field is varying. So I have small domain, okay? Some magnetic field here is changing randomly. So photon with this much bigger oscillation length starts converting randomly, and these people have calculated previously. So a few of the papers here mentioned, they have calculated that how this signal will, if each domain have a typical probability of conversion denoted by this P, then the total conversion is typically number of total domains it sees along the line of sight. If you calculate that signal with a typical estimate of G, microGauss magnetic field, about kiloparsec size, magnetic field turbulence scale of 10 to minus 4 parsec, this is 10 to minus 9. Is it good? I do not think so. This is 3 orders of magnitude below what about from Y. So one part in 10 to 9, you have to find a distortion in black body. So this is a very weak signal. What is then remaining is the resonant conversion. So resonant conversion happens. I just want to come back to this same picture again and again and to explain what exactly is the physical mechanism. This thing happens when I have the effective mass of the photon in the plasma equals the axion mass. So it enters through, it hits, it gets an axion conversion, it gets converted. It may not get converted if it is in high electron density. And you see a signal which is polarized and especially varying. So let us calculate this signal now. So we solve this problem for the, you see that in our galaxy, you see a non-adiabatic resonance conversion. Now you have a 3D model of the Jensen-Farrar magnetic field. You have a electron density model, 3D electron density model of Cordes-Lazio. For every line of sight in the psi you choose, you solve this equation. You calculate the probability of conversion from photon to axion and put that value. So this is the map
here. So magnetic field is turbulent, so
yes.
This would change a lot of you.
So if I have, let's say I have multiple resonances happening, and because of turbulent magnetic field, then you need to calculate that conversion from one state to all the states. So if you, so in that case, we can have a more general formula. I will use that. But if you see the homogeneous part, and your turbulent magnetic field is not making, turbulent electron density is not giving you a lot of resonances, then you preserve with only one of them. In case I have many resonances, then the most adiabatic one is the successful one.
Okay, so you're saying there's one that dominates everything else.
Exactly. So that's what remains.
Okay.
But it is very, I'll tell you why it is interesting. So now,
the axial mass you're choosing is 5 times 10 to the minus 13 EV, sounds like quite a precise number. Are your results going to be highly sensitive to what you choose for the axial?
Very good question. That's my second. Next slide. I'll show, come back to it. So let me first explain this, this plot. So what we solve here, and every pixel, so this is a map at 150 gigahertz of semi-photons. This region is very low. This is in log probability, 10 raised to minus 10. You see no distortion, it's like very weak because of high electron density or very high low magnetic field. As you go up, somewhere here, you see some distortion of the order 10 raised to minus 7 for axion mass 5 times 10 raised to minus 13. What happens if I change the axion mass? The signal, I have changed the axion mass a factor of 10, is because 5 times 10 raised to minus 12. The signal has changed. Why it has changed? This is a resonance conversion. So this happens when effective mass of the photon equals the axion mass. At high altitude, electron density is less. So axion mass, which is small, converts there. At low altitude, electron density is larger. So larger axion mass gets converted. As a result, when you go to lower axion mass, your signal is in towards higher altitude. If you take, let's say, 10 raised to minus 13, it will be somewhere here. And so on, and at some level, it will be outside the galactic halo, and then galaxy Milky Way is no more affecting your this signal. As you go to lower and lower axion, higher and higher axion masses, your signal starts coming down. So now I come back to your point. So for every axion mass, you can expect a template in the sky, given your electron density model. I have now a completely different way of seeing the sky for axion distortion. It is specially varying, as you can see, which is not same as CMB, synchrotron, DASP, or anything we know about. It is a polarized spectral distortion. It is specially varying, so I don't need an absolute calibrator to measure it. And this correlates with magnetic field information. So if I have probes to measure magnetic field, I can use that. So now let's make a bank of templates for different axial masses, and we can correlate that or ask for that signal in the sky.
Sure. Sorry, I mean, how sensitive is the magnetic field model? Of course, we might be able to have a good model of terminal magnetic field. So
it goes as B square, amplitude,
yeah.
But the number of resonances happens, it depends upon electron density. So let's say I don't have a very smooth electron density, but I have extremely turbulent electron density for which there are multiple resonances happening for a particular axion mass. Then locally at all those places, whatever the magnetic field part is, I'll have a signal from.
Yeah.
Then the way to solve that problem is you take the full equation and you solve it along that line of sight, and you see how much the total conversion. In this case, if I have, let's say I have very large number of resonance conversion, then the polarized signal will become unpolarized. Because it can be, magnetic field can be somewhere in some domain here and some domain here.
So I guess my point is that it's not very helpful to have templates if you have basically, it depends on the distribution of magnetic fields because there are too many possibilities. And
so the advantage is that magnetic field can be probed by other observations. Like, say, Janssen and Farrar uses synchrotron maps. So those maps can be used to generate a magnetic field model or like Faraday rotation. And you use that to construct a magnetic field model and then use it. That's what we do here. But it is very much true that for a data server, like if you want to implement an upcoming mission, we need to do this together with the magnetic field model. So where we have a data, so from synchrotron or Faraday rotations, we'll have magnetic field model. With that, you get this signal. So let me tell you this also. So what is important here is this particular shape you are getting, which is a different spectral distortion shape. I'll talk about it. If this is slightly weaker, I have no signal, but the polarization information we are not really using. We are not saying that this particular pixel have a polarization like this or like this. We are not using that. If we can use that, that's a very strong information. Let's say I have a small patch in the sky. I know the magnetic field perfectly. Then I can tell you that with in that small patch, if axions exist, I should be able to probe this value of G very accurately. But so knowing polarization structure or will magnetic field structure and then seeing the polarization structure in CMB will be very useful.
Maybe a way of asking one of my questions to say that the model seems to produce a snap that are approximate. So would you expect that, so the snap isn't exactly equal to the
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you expect it to be like 90% correlated and 10% correlated?
So if I give the magnetic, if you have a magnetic field model, with that this will show 100% correlation. But your other, so other components will have, will contribute to your noise level. When you estimate the total variance to the signal, there the fluctuations in the unknown part will also affect you. But I guess when we, if we want to generate the magnetic field templates for this signal, we will not rely on one magnetic field model. I think I'll show you one case where you do it for data. And currently, at some level, we want to get this from Planck polarization data, and we want to be as much agnostic about the magnetic field model to use it.
Can I just ask really quickly?
Yeah, sure.
Is, why does the map have like two features?
Okay. So at first, let me tell you, so this is the galactic coordinate. So when you see here, this is like, so I have a 3D structure. This is my galactic center. I'm observing from my location. I see back, and I have a conversion happening. So this point is coming far side from the Milky Way. So, are you getting my point? So along my line of sight, this point is very far along the direction. And because of the electron density there locally, you see this structure.
But what, if there were one, well, I would guess it was the galactic center, but...
So galactic center is here, yeah.
So why is it one above and one below?
That is because you, our electron density model is more or less symmetric. That's the structure, reason for this symmetric shape. But again, if you take the magnetic field model of Janssen and Farrar, you see a magnetic field is slightly higher in amplitude in the southern hemisphere. That gives, you can see, slightly stronger signal in the southern hemisphere than the northern hemisphere. Because we use the magnetic field value which Janssen and Farrar has obtained from the data as a mean value for this map, so we see a slightly higher value in the southern hemisphere than in the northern hemisphere. But what I really should say is, this template of the shape will vary as I keep on changing the electron density and magnetic field. But the search mode, the way we search in the data, is using the spectral shape, the shape of how this distortion affects the black body. And then we will ask, what is the kind of distortion you see in the observation which matches this spectral distortion? And then correlate with magnetic field or electron density shape. That's the idea. And also, just told to me by you when I was giving a talk at some other places, that you can also study the non-Gaussian structure of this particular map. Because this map is no way Gaussian. It's very different distribution. One can look for that also when you want to search for the signal. So I just go back to the next part. So I already mentioned about this, that this map is now a polarized distortion map with spectral shape different from what we so the spectral distortion of the black body, simply putting it. But there are several other contaminations. So when you talk about a nanokelvin 10⁻⁹ or 10⁻⁸ level fluctuation, you have to really care about the other contaminations which you have. Here, I plot the distortion shape in terms of intensity for polarized in terms of red, and unpolarized or axion or for non-resonant conversion in brown. The magenta one is synchrotron, the blue one is thermal dust, and this is Y, TSG. The black one is the CMB, the shape of the CMB spatial distortion. The spatial fluctuations in CMB, that is the black body derivative with respect to temperature, have a shape, which is this black line, for plus delta T and minus delta T. So what is interesting here, that the distortion, the resonant distortion, spectral shape starts very becoming very similar to the distribution of CMB photons. So you can distinguish it from singleton dust. Why? But separating it from CMB is the maximum challenge. And there we will use the fact that its shape is very much different from CMB fluctuation. Because this signal will be completely, it will not be a Gaussian distribution, but a CMB is very much Gaussian. So using that, we look for the measurement of the signal from future experiments, where we have marginalized over Y, we have marginalized over CMB, we have marginalized over dust, and we ask, not marginalized over dust, sorry, this is a plot between dust and G, so we have marginalized between CMB, we have marginalized between Y and singleton. And we ask for G, which is of order 10 raised to minus 10 GeV inverse, and axial mass of this range, what is the typical constraint we'll get? And that for different experiments, such as Lightbird, pixel-like experiment, which is having an absolute blackbody calibrator, core-like experiments, you can think about this like a pico, or like 10 times better pixel. And as you can see here, the constraints are of the order of 10 raised to minus 10 kind of signal for this axion mass. I'll show you a plot for how it compares with current other experiments or measurements. What is interesting here is because of Lightbird, I do not have enough channel for the dust, the degeneracy remains. If I have an experiment, future CMB experiment, which have many high frequency channels, then this particular constraint can be improved.
What's the
distinct
forecast here? What data
analysis
procedure?
So this is a Fisher analysis.
Like the out of power spectrum?
No, okay. So we take the map of the distortion and we make a sky model of CMB plus axion distortion plus singleton plus dust and plus Y. And then we do a Fisher analysis for this particular shape.
So is your template also being marginalized over, or no?
No. So the template information has not gone in. There's only the amplitude. So we are not saying that this particular template shape is what we are matching. No. We are saying that in a sky at a particular pixel, how much CMB I have, how much contaminations I have, and how much this signal I have. And I use all my pixels to get this number.
But I assume I have a perfect template. No.
Right, in these predictions, we have not used the information of a template. Like we are not saying anything which is not falling on this template is zero. No, that we have not used. That will even improve these constraints.
So you just assume the spectral
shape.
Okay.
We assume a spectral shape and we ask, I go to a pixel of my sky and I ask how much contaminations I have and how much is this signal I have. Now I am not asking that whether the signal shape is smooth as it along the template. That's another information you can use, but we are not using it currently. Because it's exactly the same point you made. Who knows how well are you going to measure the magnetic field? So if Lightbird goes in next 10 years, we should be able to make this measurement in next 10 years. I'll show you it is not really 10 years, even sooner it is possible.
That's why, are you using a template for the power spectrum?
No, not yet. It is just the derivative of the intensity with respect to the G parameter in the Fisher analysis. And here, because we know the magnetic field value, it's a resonant conversion, and we use the magnetic field value in that pixel. So we are not degenerate with the magnetic field value. But if we use the shape, like if you use this, let's say this particular map and go to and ask whether I have this particular distortion shape, that will be a very powerful way of measuring. But that we are not caring because we do not know, because this is not a confirmed shape of the sky. This will be typically like this.
So you're only using the
spectral information, the deviations from the background.
On your plot, the distortion seemed very similar to a thermal spectrum, as you were saying.
Yes, so I mean from the same distortion. So that's why CMB is the very strong contamination. So if you really do not include CMB, then this measurement improves a lot. So this is, let me go to the next slide and let me compare.
They are similar, but they are not the same. That's the point.
It is similar, it is same in the, or it is similar in the spectral shape, but not at all same in the sky fluctuations.
But in this forecast, you just use the spectral shape.
Yes. That's right, because we do not want to trust on the special shape at all for this initial prediction of a signal, like how it will go. So there are two things. One is spectral distortion of the black body, other is the spatial fluctuations of it. So these two together separate CMB and axion distortion.
But I guess another thing is that you need to know, as you have a certain number of pixels, that you that there are in,
yes,
in each of them.
Yes, so here we have taken about 1,000,000 pixels in the sky, like inside of 500, it is called a hill pix subroutine, and we use a parameter called inside, which is 512. And we use that for all those pixels. And we have, so for this analysis, we have also masked the sky, because you can see here, I mean, you have a galactic mass, so you cannot use it. So you have to also throw out that part of the information. We have done that also. So if you compare this with, like in the same chart for this G as a function of different cosmological probes and current bounds. So this is where the ground-based experiment bound is, or order one here in this plot. Supernova event one and then one from X-ray observation from coma cluster have these bounds. So our bound in this comparison to this are very good, but if you compare with supernova 1987, it is, I mean, this is comparable. For this, it is better. For light bar, it's almost similar. But for this, it is not. So to make the point here that our these constraints are, I should say, not very, it's not very pessimistic. You can use the template information. But we can improve better. I'll show you that, how to do that, which will, can push this way below. So if you go for ground-based experiment, this is the bound we have currently. From astrophysical sources, we have this bound. And our bound for resonant conversion is typically of this order, which will, it will be slightly better constraints for lower axion mass, so the signal will shift high, then the contamination is low, the foreground contaminations are weaker, and will be worse for higher axion mass. So, yeah.
The 0.1 pixie limit to be an entire order of magnitude better than the pixie limit.
That's right.
Whereas you'd have thought that it would be the square root of 10 if that's, if 0.1 pixie is somehow 10 times better.
So this is all in terms of G square. So we see in cosmology CMB experiments, we'll measure G square.
Right, well that's my point. If you're measuring G square, then shouldn't this be uncertainty go as the square root of the quality of the experiment. Maybe I misunderstand what you mean by 0.1.
So here you can say that for this particular signal, you'll have a, let's say, you'll have 10 raised to minus 2 kind of signal deviation in the sky. You can measure that with pixie. With 0.1 pixie means my instrument noise is 10 times better. So I will typically improve by a factor of 10 in my measurements. That's all. So it is like really measure, taking a assumed noise level of pixie, which is a order 10 to minus 10 Kelvin.
Okay, so I can see that. So to improve the pixie noise by a factor of 10, the pixie experiment has to be improved by a factor of 100.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Then I understand.
Yeah. Sorry, no problem. So let's go now from galaxy Milky Way to void. For void, this resonance conversion is not important. What is important is non-resonant, non-adiabatic conversion. For void, we know very little of it. We do not know much of the electric field, electron density. We do not know much about the magnetic field. So our here estimates are just assuming a value to show you how good it can be for this case. Here we take a nano-Gauss magnetic field in the voids. We take an electron density of the order 10 to minus 9 per centimeter cube, and we compare for that how the signal will look. The total b squared times g squared, that's what says as a here, because we can never split between g and b, and we as a function of different experiments, and we compare that with cast supernova X-ray. So for the voids, the interesting part it becomes because electron density is weak. So the probability of conversion goes up. And that gives you a slightly better signal. But this estimate is highly optimistic. We need to solve it for a three-dimensional magnetic field and electron density model for each line of sight of the voids. This is still in preparation. So we can, all I can say you now that our this signal level looks similar for each of those cubes of the magnetic field void structure, but we are yet to conclude about a more realistic 3D simulation for this and then getting the signal. So I will tell you, this is a very optimistic result for whites, please.
So you showed us before that if you don't have the resonant conversion mechanism for the Milky Way, that it was extremely minuscule.
That's for Milky Way. For
how big of a void do you have to, I assume this is just coming from the path length?
Yes, yes, exactly.
How big are you?
So you can consider a few tens of megaparsec scale. But a void for galaxies is kiloparsec scale. So they are where you win in the number, a factor of 1,000. Oh, this is the non-adiabatic, which means I have small domains of magnetic field. Then in comparison to the length scale over which photons are getting converted into axion. So this is a stochastic magnetic field. So how we generate it? We take a power spectrum of the magnetic field. From the power spectrum, we calculate the vector potential. We Fourier transform it. And then we calculate the magnetic field. And you then Fourier transform back the magnetic field in real space and calculate the signal for 3D. So this is not here. This is a case which we are studying currently. For here, we have taken a fixed value. Let's say 10 raised to minus, 10 raised to minus 9 Gauss and 10 raised to minus 9 per centimeter cube electron density. Just to see how the order of magnitude signal looks. Is it important or is it not important? Because we want to do whether we should really look for void in future or not. And that is the reason we look for this. But what becomes most interesting is galaxy clusters. So this is a project which I'll be working on David Spoet, Rishi, and Ben. This is about to submit. This is similar to the galaxy system I've talked about. So I have a galaxy cluster. I have magnetic field in it. It's aligned with this. Magnetic field is aligned with the photon. This gets converted into axion, and you get a polarized distortion. And the idea is, how can we measure this from S4 or Simons Observatory? So for this, we take the electron density model according to these papers, which typically shows you this shape as a function of the radius from the center of the cluster. So if I give you an electron density, I can ask how or at which radius I have axion conversion happening, the resonant axion conversion happening. So this plot shows you the axion mass, which will get converted into, for which there'll be a conversion, resonance conversion happening as a function of radius. For the electron density I showed you. So if you have a different electron density which you can measure from SZ measurements, you use that and you have a very predictable place to say where I'll have an axion resonant conversion happening for this electron density model. And you can see that this is plotted in terms of like 10, so this value is like 10 raised to, it's typically a nanokelvin fluctuation you will see in the sky around a cluster. This is better than that, and you can show that, okay, this is the axion mass range we will probe from future. This range is not accessible, or here it's not accessible. This part we can go if something like a factor of 10 improvement happens. I'll come up with all the plots later. What I mean is, if I see a distortion in the sky around a galaxy cluster, so I think the picture is now clear. I have a galaxy cluster, there's a magnetic field. At a particular radius, it sees the electron density decides at which radius a photon is getting converted into axion of a particular mass, which is plotted here. as a function of radius. And given the magnetic field at that point, we can estimate how much is the signal. So this plot shows you the probability of conversion from photon to axion as a function of radius from the cluster center for different rate shifts. This is for 0.1, this is for 2, rate shift of 2. The signal goes up, so what it means is, like, if I go for this particular radius, let's say 3000, this corresponds to an axial mass of order 10 raised to minus 13 electron volt. Each radius, the signal coming from each radius corresponds to a particular axion mass. So now we are searching for different axion masses from different radiuses around the cluster. And the shape of the distortion increases as you go to higher radius, because the electron density goes down there, and it shows a redshift dependence. So at higher redshift, the signal is stronger. So this is basically coming from the frequency dependence of the signal. So at the redshift of the cluster, it will get affected. So you get a 1 plus Z factor in the enhancement of a signal.
So what's the virial radius of this cluster?
So we don't have to assume the virial radius. We go for the electron density at first. We say that we model the electron density.
But just for this particular cluster that you're considering,
so this is
an idea of the scale, how do these scales?
So here we just say, so for the distortion, we do not need to care about that part of the modeling. We have to only care about, if I have a probe to say the electron density, I don't use virial radius at all in this, as of now. I just say, I have an electron density value, and at each value, I give you, the axion signal as a function of radius. Now this, I can go back into a simulation and ask how this thing varies for different assumptions of the simulation.
What mass is this? This is some particular halo mass.
Yes, yeah, right. So
it goes into this particular plot, so I just want to get an idea of the scale.
No, so.
Particular halo, what is this?
No, so here we have not taken into account the fact that how with halo mass, the electron density will change.
There's no universal electron profile, I assume.
Yes. So if we have.
This is some assumption here on what halo this corresponds. What halo is this living?
Right, but right now we are talking about how for a single cluster the signal will look. Then when you see the cluster mass, and then you can ask how the electron density for that cluster mass will change. And then I have different kind of distortion. But
which cluster mass did you assume?
Here I do not have to assume any cluster mass.
But what was the number? Sorry, this is always asking.
What's the numerical value of the mass of the virial radius?
Oh, so this cluster is, so you're asking a typical value of something like 10 raised to 12, 10 raised to 13.
Okay.
But the point, I just want to make this point here that, so you will expect, you see a cluster in SZ, you make a mass estimate, you go back, and then you do the signal for each cluster, and then you use that. The modeling will depend upon every cluster you do. That's what that's the part we can do for this particular signal. So I only need to model the electron density for each cluster.
But I think you're still saying that if you go to high redshift, it might be true that having an identical cluster at higher redshift would give a larger signal.
Mm-hmm.
Cluster mass function drops very rapidly.
Yes, that we take in the prediction level, yes. So when you predict for the measurability, then we take into account the typical clusters we'll measure as a function of redshift. And then the prediction will do that. But here I'm just at first telling you how the signal will look around a cluster. Because this is not yet, this is for the first time we are telling about a new signal you see as a radial profile in the polarization map. So that's why I'm going as a function of going slowly in this part.
So for this calculation, so are you assuming that these clusters have fairly symmetric profile with no substructure?
Yeah, here it is. So we assume that the electron density is spherical. So let's say I have an electron density distribution which goes down from center.
Yeah, so in reality, right? So
the actual clusters will have some distribution.
Along the line of sight, or overall, with R, you mean?
Well, I mean, like at each location, there will be some PDF, some histogram.
Yes. Yes.
And so are you assuming there's like a delta function at each location, or are you assuming some distribution of electron densities?
So electron density as a function of radius is what is assumed is here, this one. We assume this electron distribution, and we do not assume any turbulent part to it right now.
Okay, so I see. Okay, so I'm sure you want to know nothing. So say.
So it is spherically symmetric.
Single value at each location.
Yes. If I have turbulence, then the same assumption, the same calculation goes in. Then I have multiple resonances. I calculate the each for each line of sight. So let me just show here. So let's say I choose a particular axion mass, some low mass, I get a conversion from this radius. Now if I have turbulence, then I'll have many signals of such kind, and they will all have a total net signal at each sky location around the cluster. And that you can solve by the equations you have. Now you go to another axion mass for the same electron density model, or for that cluster. If the axion mass is very high, then you see a distortion near the cluster. So for each plus axion mass, the conversion happens at different radius. And you see a kind of a shell around you in the cluster frame.
Shell is my question.
Why I'm calling a shell?
Yeah, shouldn't you have conversion of all radii because, since your distribution of electron densities, so for a given axion mass, there's some density at which you are resident, right?
Yes, that's right. With this plot.
Everywhere, because you have some distribution.
No, but for a monotonic electron density model, which I showed you here, there is conversion happening at a fixed radius.
Yeah, but in reality, of course, actual clusters aren't just like single value. Right?
Yeah, sure, but if I have, along every line of sight, I have multiple resonances, I will calculate the signal for multiple conversions, and that's a different value, which you can calculate similarly.
Yeah, so it'll smear out your shell, I guess is my point.
Yeah, so it will be a shell for one single value, then maybe somewhere else I have another conversion, I'm seeing another shell, but in the sky, when you project it, it will be a disk. So in your, because it's a disk in the sky, so you will go to see for a signal around a cluster for a given fixed radius. And that what sets the axion mass. So this we will not be able to see from the observation. So in the sky you will see a signal like this. I'll show you some more results on this. Like let's say a circular distortion. A patch in the sky around the cluster from which you have a particular spectral shape. But now let's simulate this signal. Let's take an electron density model which I have shown you. A magnetic field which goes, we take a model which is like square root of R goes down as in the signal. And we take foreground maps, we take CMB, and we ask how this signal looks in the sky, actually. So for this, we take a sky model, let's say this is our observation at a particular frequency and a pixel, which is given by this spectral shape you have, that kind of distortion you're talking about, maybe CMB, maybe axion distortion, synchrotron, dust, and you have noise. So you produce several simulations of the sky, which is generated using this Python sky model code. Here I am showing for two different frequencies. This is for 230, this is for 28 gigahertz, the synchrotron and dust. Each in the sky location, you also add CMB. Then you go to random location in the sky, you add clusters. On that, you add the signal of the axion distortion. Here we have assumed a very simple case that I know the magnetic field values, I have an electron density, so I have a clustered signal around it. And I ask how the signal looks in the sky. For that, I have to clean now the signal. I have added all different contaminations. So I add, I do use a method called internal linear combination. It's called ILC, where from the observation, you fit for a given spectrum. We fit for axion spectrum. And you get a map for the axion distortion around the cluster. So here you clean it, the locally at each cluster location. And after adding 1,000 maps, this is the kind of signal you expect. So here I come to your point. When you see in the observation, this will be some appearing something like a very smear structure. Like you can hardly make out a disk from this, right? It's like there are substructures here because of several other contaminations. But if you subtract this from the underlying noise, you will see something like this. This is the assumed value of the signal which you have injected. And we showed that we recovered it from our analysis method. So we at first make it dirty by adding synchrotron, dust, and CMB. We do ILC, we clean it, and we recover the similar signal which was injected. So in the sky, you can think the signal will look something like this. This is for a particular axion mass, like 5 times 10 to minus 13 electron volt. This part, as this will show some redshift dependence, I am showing here, I have plotted here for three cases, 0.1, 1.1, and 1.4. So because the cluster will look smaller when it is far away, even for a fixed axion mass, the signal will come from a smaller region. So here, just to show you for the eye, I have plotted this black line on top of this figure. So this is the kind of signal where this signal is present. For redshift 1.1, same axion mass, you will observe a signal like this. And for redshift 1.4, the distortion will be like this one. So the function of cluster redshift, we will see a signal from a fixed for a particular axion mass from different radiuses and with different amplitudes. And when you add a simulation, realistic sky will appear something like this. On top, for each cluster, if I have different electron density models, they will have slightly different shapes for each of them. Now, if I have a proxy to measure this for each cluster, we have to use it before doing the axion cleaning or before making the measurement for axions. But that's why I was saying that this will go at the analysis level. When you do the analysis for actual cluster, actual observations. But on the modeling part, I was taking a fixed value and to show that even for that, how the contamination actually looks in the sky. So now let's talk about the measurement, the detectability of this. So the first thing which comes is, I told you that the resonance conversion is happening for a particular mass from a particular radius. So if I go to a very high axion mass, electron density has to be larger for making a resonance conversion. So it has to be near the core. So if I go very far, I will not be able to measure it. I will not be able to resolve it from my experiment. So in this plot, I have plotted the axion masses as a function of redshift for different instrument beam of CMB, which we can measure, we can resolve in the sky. So if it is nearby, then I can measure high axion masses, which is near the small radius. As I go farther, I will not be able to measure it well, and I will not be able to measure high masses well, and then it just saturates at some value. So this is our ultimate bound for a given resolution, which sets on the axion masses, what axion mass we can detect from a given experiment of a particular beam. So when you do this, we use the CMB S4, and Simon's observatory noise level. And we ask, we include foregrounds, we include CMB, and we do the cleaning. But we use the fact that there is a polarized spectral distortion, so CMB we use the polarized part of the CMB. And we ask, what is the measurability of this signal when you take clusters according to the distributions you expect? So here we take the cluster distribution following the Simon's observatory and S4. So for those who are, so just to mention that like Simon's Observatory will be coming like 2-3 years from now. And it's going to measure wide science goals, which includes cluster physics, which includes B-mode polarization. And this now is also a possibility to measure from S4 or SO at the level. So this blue line is for Simon's Observatory. This place is where I assume that I do not know the cluster magnetic field information very well. So I do not use this per information at all. So this is the, you go far from the cluster center. Far from the cluster center means you have low axial masses you're probing. As you go to high axial masses, it is towards the, near the core, and you have a resolution cutoff. In between is what you are going to probe from S4 and SO. So this is plotted in terms of 10 to minus 12 electron volt, 10 to minus 12 GeV inverse, sorry. And this is now much, much better than our current CAST experiments. And this is typically you gain because of the number of clusters you have. So the idea is now that you go to the polarization map, you measure a signal, you detect clusters in SZ. Then you go to the same location in the polarization map. You go there and you fit for the axial distortion, you clean other spectrum, and you ask what is the other distortion you see which follows axial spectral shape. Using that, we see you can make a better measurement from when you add all the clusters. So
the bounds are really better than current bounds. S4 or S4.
Yeah, so this is
exactly. What about like Planck, right?
Planck.
Why not do the data analysis now?
You mean now?
Yeah.
I have a plot for that.
Okay.
Sorry. So let's answer your question. What happens to the Planck data? I have told you this is a specially varying. So I don't need an absolute black body calibrator in the instrument to measure it. If I have a specially fluctuating signal, I can measure this distortion. So use the temperature data of Planck. So the polarization data is in preparation. So when this was done, that time the final polarization result was not out. So use the temperature data. So here, Planck sees the sky in 9 channels, as plotted here. We used these 6 channels in our data to clean the sky. So, and as you can see, this is our sky model. I showed you earlier that this is of those sky is like all contaminations you have with a particular shape of the distortion and the noise. And because Planck doesn't see a single frequency, there's a bandwidth. For each frequency it observes, so there is a smearing, so to correct for the window function for each bandwidth. We do that, and this is how the shape of the distortion will appear in the Planck channel for Planck experiments. The magenta one is the CMB, which doesn't vary. It's in the temperature units of CMB, so it doesn't vary. The blue one is your axial distortion, so you can see it's a slightly different shape. And Y is very different shape. So we use this blue spectrum now to clean the CMB maps, to get the all sky axial distortion map. And this is this plot. This is the all sky map of axial distortion, or you can say axial-like distortion, which is, follows that particular shape. We have not used the information of the pixel or the template. We just use the shape here, and you get this constraint map. So this is with 5 arc minute resolution. It means we have removed all the information below 15 arc minute with the Gaussian beam, and we have used 45% of the sky to reduce the contamination. This signal is just a noise dominated signal. So if you see the half ring half sum and the half ring half difference. So half ring half sum means you have several, you see the maps, you take a summation, a sum of it, or take a difference of it. The difference map is a noise map. The sum map is both signal plus noise. And you can see that the 1D PDF of this alpha, what is called axial distortion, looks like this. And these are the point sources. So this map, we already removed a lot of more clusters than is what Planck provides, to make sure that you reduce the contamination. And this PDF is for the noise, which is very much Gaussian, but not the sky map distortion. So now we can ask, how good is this bound?
So what do you think is responsible? What sources of emission do you think is responsible for this long tail?
This is the point sources. We have removed many point sources which are not removed, which is not there in this Mika map mask, but some of them still remained. And this is the reason for it. We tried.
Dusty source
or radiant source? These are SGs. So you, if you see the power spectrum, you see a rays in the CL. So we expect there's a, some SG residual, but there is no CMB residual. It's very interesting. If you do, so if you clean it, you can see there's a CMB bump. You remove the, you do the cleaning with higher channels, you remove the power spectrum of CL. The power spectrum doesn't look like CL. So you remove the CL very accurately, CMB very accurately here. If you use four channels, you see some CMB residuals. Like if I use 100, 143, 217, and 353, I see a residual from CMB. That's why we use all the six channels to clean it, these six channels. So in the paper, we have given the results for all of them and to show how it varies. Yeah, sure.
I think I'm just confused. So you told us a few slides ago that the most important part was coming from the clusters, but now you're removing all the clusters.
No, so
what part of the signal, I guess I'm confused.
So this is about from the part which is Milky Way. That's right, yes. From CUST, so there's an ongoing idea that we'll apply this to ACT data, and we do the cluster search from the ACT data, and whatever bounds we'll get, we'll have the kind of a first distortion measurements from axion around clusters, but that is not yet implemented. But just to mention, this distortion, this from the data of the Planck data, AllSky, is 10 times weaker than current bound from CUST. Because we, for Planck data, we do not expect to get it. With the Planck noise, we are, the result we see show here is factor of 10 worse than Planck, than CUST. But with measurement from clusters, this is going to improve. So the, for my first part of the talk, which I say, I think I'm done more or less, that we have axion on the site, and we can now probe it from Milky Way, from void, and from clusters. With a, so I would say there's a lot of things to do here because we need to in the set up the pipeline for the polarization data and to get it. But this is an interesting way to get it from the cosmological setup itself. So do I have some time?
A few minutes.
A few minutes, okay. So I would like to just mention that now, maybe in 20s, in next 10 years, we'll have a lot of spectral distortion map along with the B-mode map from several different axion signals, from fluctuating y, also constant maybe from fluctuating mu. But as I already mentioned to you that I have few other topics which I found interesting to work. And one of the things which I was recently working was about how to measure dark energy parameters or about cosmic acceleration from supernovae, which are, do not have the redshift information. So from LSST, we are going to see many supernovas, like 10 to 4 to 10 to 5 supernovas every year. But now they may not have the, they will not have the spectroscopic redshift information. We have to rely on the photometric redshift. So can we improve it? So the idea over here is that the supernovas you see in the sky, and you use a spectroscopic redshift information, a luminosity distance, and the luminosity redshift distance relationship to get the parameters. The supernovas are not distributed randomly in the sky, right? It follows an underlying structure. It follows the distribution of the galaxy. Supernovas happens in the galaxy. It follows a spatial structure. So now if you ask that, if you just focus on one of them, let's say, so here my yellow is the supernova and I have an underlying structure, that here with, I have a supernova burst, I see a host galaxy. So this is how we do it. We have a galaxy for which you know the redshift. We identify it as a host of the supernova, and we make the measurement. But what about all other galaxies which we have? So what we propose now is we can do a supernova correlation with the galaxies. This is going to improve the redshift information more than the photometric case, which currently LSST is considering. So LSST predictions are all using like 0.02 kind of sigma z, typically. And we are going to improve that if you consider a galaxy survey like Euclid, which has the spectroscopic redshift information. And this is our constraint on that, for on dark energy parameters. So let's focus on one of them finally, like W naught and WA. For different scenarios, this is for photometric redshift, this is for spectroscopic redshift, the blue one, and this is for two different cases with high Kmax cut. You put at, you remove some power from the power spectrum at high K. So our estimate shows that this is going to be one of the best way to explore dark energy parameters, not to only rely on the photometric redshift, but to also use the correlation with the galaxies. So I'd like to talk more on this if you guys, whenever you have time. The other part which I was looking into is like, can we do cosmology with gravitational waves? Of course we can do. And can we go beyond the idea of doing cosmology with standard sirens? Like we measure, we do a luminous ray distance test, or we know the DL, we may measure and get the cosmological parameters from gravitational resources. So here I'm going to talk about experiments like future experiment, ground-based, like Cosmic Explorer, and like LISA. So Cosmic Explorer is going to measure like 100 hertz, typically 100 hertz band of frequency gravitational signal. This is this black line here. For LISA, the space-based mission is measuring about 10, in this is a noise curve with sweet spot around 10 to minus 2. I'm going to measure very different kinds of signal over a huge frequency range. So the idea is, what can I do from here about the cosmology part? So one thing, of course, we do is the luminosity distance test. The other part which is remaining to do is, what about the imprints of the cosmic structure on it? We know now that one of the main problem to gravitational wave sources is the lensing. So gravitational wave gets lensed. And can we infer this from the gravitational wave data, or the individual sources? So the idea which we propose here, is you correlate the cosmological probes with the individual compact object sources. It's the strain of the individual compact object sources. So because of lensing, the signal, the amplitude will be looking slightly bigger, I'll talk about it, and it can be correlated with the CMB field. So I have a lensing map from CMB. For each compact object, I have a lensed signal, lensed gravitational wave strain. I correlate the strain along each line of sight, and because of lensing, they will show me a particular signal. If I can measure this signal now, first of all, I can do cosmology with this. Secondly, one can think about removing the signal. Like de-lensing of gravitational wave sources, using different cosmological probes, like CMB, like galaxy surface. So let's put the idea over here. This is the Planck lensing map, and we expect to see many sources in the sky in different locations. Each of the strain will be either small or big, different depending upon whether the line of sight integrated mass you are seeing is more or less, the overall fluctuation. And you correlate this distribution with the CMB map. And we do a focus for this measurement, and we see that this particular way, we can get about 10 of a few, like below 10, but above 3, this region, signal to noise ratio in the measurement of the signal. So this is shown as a function of redshift. So as you go to higher and higher redshift, which LISA will go, we will be able to make this measurement accurately. Of course, this quantity measure depends upon the sky localization area. So if I have a very poor sky localization area, then the correlation signal between CMB and the gravitational sources reduces. So as a result, the overall SNR goes down, as you can see from this violet one to the blue one. And this dotted and dashed line are obtained for different numbers of sources. The dash one is for 50 sources per unit redshift bin, and the other one is for 300 per unit redshift bin. And this is a solar mass of 10 to 4. LISA is going to measure 10 raised to 4 to 10 raised to 7 solar mass objects. For each masses, we are going to have this measurement. So that is going to, the total measurement is of course going to be more than what I showed here as a root, like factor of 10, like 10 sigma or so. For ground-based experiment, like Cosmic Explorer, which is on the proposal now, with the current, like the typical number, which is LIGO is proposing for to see, like either 2 or 600, with the sky localization area of about 10 degree or about 2 degree, this is the prediction level for the SNR as a function of redshift. So we can measure the lensing signal from gravitational wave sources using the correlation with the CMB, and similarly with the correlation with other galaxy surface. And as a function of redshift, we have plotted here, and this is more than 10. Now the point comes that if the number of gravitational wave sources for LIGO, they see much more, let's say maybe by a factor of 10 or 20 more, then this signal can be detectable even from advanced LIGO, about 3 to 4 sigma level from redshift about near 2 or 1.8. So from the ground-based experiment, current surveys, we can use this to measure the correlation between lensing of gravitational wave and lensing of photons. Now this particular thing is of course interesting to measure lensing field. It's also interesting for several fundamental physics questions. One of them is whether to show that the trajectory of the photons and the gravitational waves, or the gravitons, are same. So because at the correlation level, like when it follows the perturbations, they show a correlation, this particular signal will show you, will be a method to, additional method to show you that this signal exists. The other one is to measurement of the extra dimensions. So very recently, the LIGO paper 2018 have shown that a bound from the neutron star event, but our this approach is going to be an additional way to measure the extra dimensions. So what happens is because of extra dimension, the strain goes down of the gravitational wave, which is completely degenerate with the lensing signal. So if we can use the lensing information, then we can remove this part and we can measure it, measure the extra dimension constant more accurately. And other approach is that several alternative theories of gravity predicts that the strain can be decayed as it propagates, as the gravitational wave propagates. This is different from the just a constraint on the difference in the speed of gravitational wave and photons. And this way that you can measure the lensing signal accurately is also going to remove the degeneracy and improve the measurement of this alternative theories of gravity. So I would like to talk more on this when you have time. I mean, I couldn't explain all the scopes here more in details. So with here I'll conclude that we have a few new frontiers in cosmology. We have a lot of new experiments coming. I have worked on a few of them and I'm listing here. We can probe axions from the upcoming CMB experiments. In next, maybe next 5 years, we have a very good constraint. Using Euclid, LSST, DESY, and with the concept of clustering redshift on supernovae, we can use supernovae better than we currently can do with photometric redshift measurements. And with advanced LIGO, possibly, and surely for LISA and Cosmic Explorer, this new approach of doing cosmology by using several probes which are probing the electromagnetic part with the part which is the gravitational wave part will be an interesting way. And of course, I talked with Neil very recently that this is a very good idea also for galaxy surveys to do, which we can also explore. Thank you.